This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. As summer marches on and fall comes into view, the question of schools is coming into sharp focus. A debate, a full-on battle, really, is raging about whether schools should reopen their doors for kids.
Yeah, the president has said unmistakably that he wants schools to open, and I was just in the Oval talking to him about that. And when he says open, he means open and full, kids being able to attend each and every day at their school. The science should not stand in the way of this.
But if you're the teacher standing face-to-face with 35 kids, or if you're a principal for that matter, or an education official, or a governor, you may want to consider the science, but that gets tricky. This pandemic is not much more than half a year old, and there's no definitive set of data to guide us. So what do we know about this seemingly impossible problem? The New Yorker's Joshua Rothman talked last week with Emily Oster, an economist at Brown University. Oster has written bestsellers on pregnancy and parenting from a database perspective, and she co-authors the website COVID Explained.
So maybe we should start with the first of three questions, which is, how dangerous is the coronavirus to children?
I think the answer is that this is the least affected group. So that's different than saying it's not dangerous. And some of the things you will hear are people saying, you know, oh, kids can't get it. Kids don't get it. No kids ever get it. That's not true. Kids can get it. They can get very sick. There have been pediatric deaths. We now have a lot of data from a lot of different locations that really suggest that kids tend to have mild illness and they are less likely to get sick. So I think that piece of it is pretty reassuring.
And does anyone know why? Why would that be?
So there's some discussion, and now we're like a little bit beyond my science skills, but there's some discussions about ACE2 inhibitors and like different levels of ACE2 enzymes. But I don't think we really have an answer to that question yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one thing I've been like low key freaking out about for myself, I have a 2-year-old son, and we were, you know, our version of this debate was sending him to pre-K. And, you know, I had read the papers about how, you know, like basically the kind of scary version of COVID is something that kids don't really seem to get in any kind of significant numbers. But then I was starting to, you know, learn about like, you know, there are things that happen decades after you get a virus, like shingles is a consequence of chickenpox, or there are like various weird things that happen like 10 years after you get the measles. I mean, how do you think about it being an unknown virus, I guess is what I'm asking, or a new weird creepy virus?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is part of what's hard, is that people are sort of constantly running through their heads, well, what if in 20 years we find out that this had this long-term impact that we didn't know about it? And I think, yes, you know, you're right that that's really scary. Now, that's always true, right? So there's you're kind of frequently experiencing things where we don't really know, or experiencing things where we do know that there are potentially long-term consequences like the flu. Flu is actually way more dangerous than COVID for kids based on the data. And so you're already kind of taking some of these risks. And I think that they're just not really salient every day. Mm. But the fact that like there could be something bad that happens later, is hard to factor into your decision making because, of course, there could always be something bad that happens later, and you cannot wait 20 years to decide whether to send your 2-year-old to daycare.
Yeah. Yeah, that totally makes sense. So what about kids being vectors or giving the virus to each other?
So this is a place where I think we have sort of growing data, but it is actually more complicated and less, like, it's less obvious than the case of how sick kids get. So so for a while, there was some discussion, like, kids don't transmit, like, they don't transmit at all, so we shouldn't, like, worry about that. I think what is true is they do seem to transmit less. We have a number of, I would say, examples that are reassuring. So cases where there was an infected kid and they interacted with a lot of other people and nobody got sick. I think our best data on this probably just came out, and it's like a little bit mixed. So there's a big study from South Korea, which looked at a bunch of cases and then looked at their contacts. So South Korea does much better contact tracing than elsewhere. So they had traced, you know, they have like 6,000 cases and 60,000 contacts.
Right.
So to put some numbers on it, so if you have a little kid in the study who has COVID, that's a kid under 10, they find only about 5% of their parents or people they live with get COVID. So that's a really low transmission rate. It's much lower than other groups. So adults look like the transmission rate there would be something like 11 or 12%. So that would say adults would transmit to 11 to 12% of people in their household. For kids in their teens, that's the 10 to 19 age group, they were still much less likely to be infected than other people in the population. But conditional on being infected, they transmitted to their household contacts at a rate that was sort of similar to adults. So there's a little bit of a mixed bag for the older kids, and suggests there's an important difference between the younger and the older age groups within kids.
So, I mean, does that suggest that we should be having two pretty distinct conversations, like one about high school kids, essentially how to keep those schools closed, and then one about elementary school kids and essentially how to open those schools?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's unreasonable to say that we should privilege different groups differently for this reopening conversation. One of the ways we could do that is with age. And we could say basically we should be thinking about how to open for elementary school kids and maybe about how to use space in high schools or in, you know, in middle schools to, like, de-densify our elementary school classrooms. And the other piece of this that lines up well with that kind of plan is that the kind of distance learning losses, like, how good is distance learning, is pretty different for little kids and for older kids. So it's not that easy to teach a 5-year-old on Zoom. And also some of what you're trying to convey is sort of like, how do you interact with other 5-year-olds? Whereas for high school kids, of course, like, socialization is important. It's easier for them to socialize on their own. And also the, like, learning piece, it's easier to do on the computer. So I think that's not crazy. I think the other place that we should sort of be talking about prioritization is to just recognize that people have different resources. And so, you know, within a bunch of sixth graders in a large urban school district, you're going to have kids where, you know, their parents can be home with them and, you know, they are capable of, like, supervising them doing online learning. And then you're going to have cases where kids, you know, live in homeless shelters or in other kinds of unstable environments with no internet. And we should prioritize those kids for in-person education if we have to choose, I think.
And then on the third question, which is adults who work in schools giving it to one another. Like, what do we know about that?
So I think that what we know about that is kind of the same as what we would know about this in any kind of office setting. And I think we have to think the same would need to be true about schools. You know, we can't have faculty break rooms. We can't have faculty kitchens. You know, we're going to need to think about PPE. I mean, there's a lot of those kind of considerations that are going into opening offices that I haven't seen it talked about as much in the cases of schools. So we spent a lot of time in schools on sort of thinking about the protections that have to do with interactions between teachers or between staff and students, and much less about the interaction between staff and staff, which of course probably are the highest risk interactions because those are the people who are, you know, most likely to spread it to each other.
Economist Emily Oster talking with The New Yorker's Joshua Rothman. We'll continue in a moment.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
So I imagine you as a person who's just at the center of a huge amount of communication from parents, from teachers, from education people about this problem, this question. I guess part of it is a lot of places thought, well, there were a lot of people thinking that in a sort of wishful thinking way that this would just automatically be over by, you know, at some point in the summer. And maybe this is just one of those decisions that's so hard to make. You can't guarantee anything to anybody.
I think one of the things places thought that they were going to be able to somehow think about this in a sort of like cost and benefit trade-off way. And then it became like very emotional in a way that maybe wasn't expected and makes it very hard to make decisions like that. So, you know, when you announce that you're going to reopen schools and then people are like, do you want me to die? You like, you know, basically when the teachers union comes and they say like, do you want me to die? Like you want me to go, you're going to make me go to work so I can die. And then you realize as an administrator, like if you reopen schools, in fact, even if you don't reopen schools, in general, there will be some people who are teachers who unfortunately will die because a lot of people are going to die of COVID because it is a terrible disease that we really need to like be addressing more aggressively. But what's going to happen if you open schools is that some people are going to get this and some of them may die. And then what are you going to do? And so I think that was the thing that sort of people came up against, that they maybe weren't expecting.
Right. Like normally this is in fact, on some level, it's a life and death decision, even though on another level, it's an education. It's about, well, let me frame it a different way. I mean, how much do we know about what it means for kids to miss a year of school? Is that something we know about, like what the impacts are on children who are out of school for a year?
Yeah, so I think we know that it is really bad for kids to lose out on schooling, and we know that like there were very large learning losses in the spring. Those learning losses are concentrated in students of color and low-income students. I mean, they're concentrated in low-income schools. You can see this in the data. It's comparable, you know, it's sort of it's the same thing we see when we look at summer learning loss. If we go online for a school year and, you know, things are anything like they were in the spring, there are going to be a bunch of kids who drop out. Those are going to be from particular demographic groups. You know, we're going to see basically an exacerbation of some pre-existing inequalities. I mean, we saw this today, like all of my Twitter feed today is about educational pods. Oh, we're going to have a learning pod. We're going to have a learning bubble. Guess who's having learning bubbles? It's the rich, right? Or at least, you know, people who are like relatively better off than the average. And so I think all of this stuff is going to be very bad in the long term. And we know that people who get less education have worse health outcomes later, make less money, have all kinds of other sort of long-term impacts. And I have made this point on in various ways. And one of the pieces of pushback you get is, you know, well, it would be worse to be dead. If you open schools and even one kid dies of COVID as a result of school openings, then that's worse than all of these learning losses. We don't really have a way to talk about how we trade those things off. We have, I mean, economists have a framework, but it's the kind of reason that people hate us, right? Because we're going to go out there and say, well, you know, the like the long run, like mortality, higher mortality among this entire cohort of students outweighs the like life years lost of one, you know, of one student dying of COVID. But nobody wants to be out there saying that. I mean, I don't want to be saying that. Nobody wants to say that. And I think that that's part of what makes this just really hard to talk about.
So, I mean, would it be better for school districts to just decide now very clearly, you know, to avoid being, you know, the flat squirrel and just decide we're going to pursue opening and then there's certain consequences that flow from that in terms of decisions that need to be made, or to decide we're going to sort of be as conservative as possible and then, you know, pull all your resources into making it work that way? Is flip-flopping bad here?
Yes, flip-flopping is bad. And I think this is something, like a lot of school districts had this attitude of we're just going to wait as long as possible to have as most information as possible. And I think it was driving parents crazy. And there actually are like a number of people, even in California, where like, so I texted a friend of mine the other day, and I was like, I'm so sorry that LA has decided not to open. And she was basically like, you know, like, I just am glad that I know. Because now I can like, yes, I wish we could be in person, but now at least I understand what I'm, you know, what I'm up against. Parents were like, okay, let me try to think about like, how am I going to make this work? The piece that I'm worried about, from just to tell you about like what is keeping me personally up at night about my life, is that I live in a place where there's currently the plan is to open schools in person, like more or less full time, at least for elementary schools. But I am worried that we're going to get 2 weeks in and there's going to be, you know, a case in my kid's school. And like, you know, realistically, that's even in a low prevalence place, like that's going to happen. And that then I'm not sure what the plans are in terms of like the reaction, right? So it would almost be worse to send the kids back for 2 weeks and then have to pull them out again because I wouldn't be prepared for that.
Now, what if you lived in a state, like a state where you just didn't trust the decision-making about coronavirus? I mean, I think that's a situation a lot of parents around the country are in or worry that they may be in. This is one of these weird moments where everyone is making their own judgment calls about what's safe, what's acceptable, I guess.
So I think it's very, you know, I think that in that case, a lot of people are going to be thinking about it as it's not a good idea to send my kid. And I suspect that I would be in the same boat. You know, I'm pretty into school, and so I'd really like my kids to be in school, but I'm not sure that, you know, from a public health standpoint, I could really decide to send them, even if I wasn't worried about them at all. I'm not sure it would be a good idea to decide to send them in a place with where, you know, a lot of people are being infected every day, partly because I would just feel like that was not like socially the choice that I would make. But I also think we're going to have to accept that there isn't actually a right choice in that people are going to differ in what they think is the right thing to do. And that we probably, it's not going to help any of this discourse for people to yell at each other and tell them they're doing it wrong. It's just hard to put yourself in other people's shoes on those kind of choices.
Emily Oster, an economist from Brown University. She's also the author of Crib Sheet and Expecting Better. She spoke with The New Yorker's Josh Rothman. I'm David Remnick. That's The New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.